In 2009, I worked with Alan Keenan, a postdoctoral scientist in my laboratory, to compare genetic variation on the X chromosome, the larger of our two sex chromosomes, to the rest of the genome. To our surprise, we found much less genetic variation in non-Africans on chromosome X than would be expected from the level of variation in the rest of the genome. Assuming that males and females participated equally in the founding of the ancestral population of non-Africans. The pattern was too extreme to be explained by a simple scenario of more men than women participating in the founding of the ancestral population of non-Africans. But we discovered that one scenario that could explain the pattern is that after the initial budding off of the ancestral population of non-Africans, there was genetic input into this population from males of other groups. Since males carry one copy of chromosome X for every two copies of other chromosomes, a process of repeated waves of male immigration would decrease X chromosome diversity, meaning that there would be less genetic variation in the population compared to the rest of the genome, producing the pattern we observed. This hypothesis gains some plausibility from what we know of the interaction of Central African pygmy hunter-gatherer populations with the Bantu-speaking agriculturalist populations that surround them. When the Bantu first expanded out of West Central Africa several thousand years ago, they had a profound influence on the indigenous rainforest hunter-gatherer populations they encountered, as is evident from the fact that today, no pygmies speak a non-Bantu language, and all harbor substantial Bantu-related ancestry. Even today, the overwhelming pattern is that Bantu men mix with pygmy women, and the children are raised in pygmy communities. The waves of Bantu-related gene flow into the pygmy population are similar to the scenario that Keenan and I had suggested for the ancestral population of non-Africans. The genetic consequence of this anthropological pattern is reflected in pygmies having a substantially reduced degree of genetic diversity on chromosome X compared to the expectation from the rest of the genome. Perhaps similar processes were at work in the shared history of non-Africans, explaining the reduced X chromosome diversity relative to the rest of the genome in that case too. Evidence of sex bias in the mixture of human populations is becoming commonplace. The male-biased European contribution to admixed populations in the Americas is stark in African Americans, but it is truly extraordinary in populations in South and Central America, reflecting stories like that of Hernan Cortes and La Malinche. Andres Ruiz Linares and colleagues have documented how in the Antioquia region of Colombia, which was relatively isolated between the 16th and 19th centuries, about 94% of the Y chromosomes are European in origin, whereas about 90% of the mitochondrial DNA sequences are of Native American origin. This reflects social selection against Native American men. Because nearly all the male ancestry comes from Europeans, and nearly all the female ancestry comes from Native Americans, one might naively expect that the people of Antioquia today would derive about half their genome-wide ancestry from Europeans and half from Native Americans. But this is not the case. Instead, about 80% of Antioquian ancestry comes from Europeans. The explanation is that Antioquia was flooded by male migrants over many generations. The first European men to arrive mixed with Native American women. Additional European male migrants came later. Through repeated waves of male European migration, the proportion of European ancestry kept increasing everywhere in the genome, except for mitochondrial DNA, because mitochondrial DNA is passed to the next generation entirely by females. Massive sex bias and population mixture also occurred between 4,000 and 2,000 years ago, during the formation of the present-day populations of India. As discussed in Part 2, endogamous groups in India with traditionally higher social status tend to have more West Eurasian-related ancestry than groups with traditionally lower social status. And the effect is highly sex-biased, as mitochondrial DNA tends to be largely of local origin, whereas a much higher proportion of Y chromosome types have affinity to West Eurasians. This pattern plausibly reflects a history in which males of West Eurasian-related ancestry were more highly placed in the caste system and sometimes married lower-ranking females. It speaks to a dramatic coming together of socially unequal populations to form the present genetic structure of India. DNA has the power to overturn expectations from other fields, though. And in this case, it has also revealed a surprise about sex-biased mixture. Today, almost every Pacific Island population harbors some of its ancestry from people of mainland East Asian origin. As described in Part 2, this ancestry derives from people whose ancestors originated on Taiwan Island and who invented long-distance seafaring and used it to disperse their people, language, and genes. But almost every Pacific Island population also harbors Papuan ancestry, related to the indigenous hunter-gatherers of the island of New Guinea. Surprisingly, in light of the theme that males from an expanding population tend to mix with local females, initial studies of mitochondrial DNA and Y chromosomes showed that the mixed populations of the Pacific today derive most of their East Asian origin DNA not from male, but from female ancestors. One explanation that has been suggested for this pattern is that in early Pacific Island societies, property usually passed down the female line, and males were the primary people who moved across islands. But there is another process that may also have contributed. As described in Part 2, my laboratory showed that the first people of the open Pacific had little Papuan-related ancestry. We showed that later, west-to-east waves of migration of people of mixed Papuan and mainland East Asian ancestry explain ubiquity of Papuan ancestry in the remote Pacific today. If males from this later arriving population had social advantages relative to the previously resident population, this could have resulted in newly arriving males of primarily Papuan ancestry mixing with previously established females of primarily East Asian-related ancestry. The Pacific Islander example highlights the importance of not simply assuming that genetic analyses of sex-biased events will fulfill expectations from anthropology. Now that the genome revolution has arrived, with its power to reject long-standing theories, we need to abandon the practice of approaching questions about the human past with strong expectations. To understand who we are, we need to approach the past with humility and with an open mind, and to be ready to change our minds out of respect for the power of hard data. The future of genetic studies of inequality. At the present time, our methods for using genetic data to study sex bias in human history are frustratingly primitive. Many of the most interesting findings about sex bias so far have been based on just two locations in the genome, the Y chromosome and mitochondrial DNA, which reflect only tiny fractions of our family trees. Studies of sex-biased population dynamics using these sections of the genome become nearly useless for understanding events that occurred more than around 10,000 years ago, because at that time depth, everyone in the world descends from only a small handful of male and female ancestors, who are too few in number to support a statistically precise measurement of sex bias. Future studies of sex-biased mixture, though, will take full advantage of the power of the whole genome. Whole genome studies can compare the thousands of independent genealogies recorded on chromosome X to the tens of thousands of independent genealogies carried in the rest of the genome. Comparison of genetic variation on the X chromosome to genetic variation elsewhere in the genome should, in theory, give far more statistical resolution. But while some studies of this sort have been revealing, the accuracy of their estimates has so far been disappointing, which may be because of intense bouts of natural selection that have affected chromosome X more than other chromosomes, and that make interpretations of its patterns more difficult. So while many major mixture events, such as those of steppe pastoralists and farmers in Europe, or of Neanderthals and Denisovans with modern humans further back in human prehistory, may well have been sex-biased, detecting them by comparing fractions of ancestry on chromosome X to the rest of the genome is currently challenging. But our present problems with making precise estimates of sex bias based on the X chromosome are to a large extent technical, reflecting the limitations of the statistical techniques currently available. New methods that will be developed over the coming years will unleash the full power of comparison of the X chromosome to the rest of the genome. I hope that these improved methods, along with direct ancient DNA data from people who lived at the times mixture was happening, will enable new genomic insights into the nature of inequality in the deep human past. The genomic evidence of the antiquity of inequality between men and women, and between people of the same sex but with greater and lesser power, is sobering in light of the undeniable persistence of inequality today. One possible response might be to conclude that inequality is part of human nature and that we should just accept it. But I think the lesson is just the opposite. Constant effort to struggle against our demons, against the social and behavioral habits that are built into our biology, is one of the ennobling behaviors of which we humans as a species are capable, and which has been critical to many of our triumphs and achievements. Evidence of the antiquity of inequality should motivate us to deal in a more sophisticated way with it today, and to behave a little better in our own time. 11. The genomics of race and identity. Fear of biological difference. When I started my first academic job in 2003, I bet my career on the idea that the history of mixture of West Africans and Europeans in the Americas would make it possible to find risk factors that contribute to health disparities for diseases like prostate cancer, which occurs at about a rate 1.7 times higher in African Americans than in European Americans. This particular disparity had not been possible to explain based on dietary and environmental differences across populations, suggesting that genetic factors might play a role. African Americans today derive about 80% of their ancestry from enslaved Africans brought to North America between the 16th and 19th centuries. In a large group of African Americans, the proportion of African ancestry at any one location in the genome is expected to be close to the average, defining the proportion of African ancestry as the fraction of ancestors that were in West Africa before around 500 years ago. However, if there are risk factors for prostate cancer that occur at higher frequency in West Africans than in Europeans, then African Americans with prostate cancer are expected to have inherited more African ancestry than the average in the vicinity of these genetic variations. This idea can be used to pinpoint disease genes. To make such studies possible, I set up a molecular biology laboratory to identify mutations that differed in frequency between West Africans and Europeans. My colleagues and I developed methods that used information from these mutations to identify where in the genome people harbor segments of DNA derived from their West African and European ancestors. To prove that these ideas worked in practice, we applied them to many traits, including prostate cancer, uterine fibroids, late-stage kidney disease, multiple sclerosis, low white blood cell count, and type 2 diabetes. In 2006, my colleagues and I applied our methods to 1,597 African-American men with prostate cancer, and found that in one region of the genome, they had about 2.8% more African ancestry than the average in the rest of their genomes. The odds of seeing a rise in African ancestry this large by accident were about 10 million to 1. When we looked in more detail, we found that this region contained at least 7 independent risk factors for prostate cancer, all more common in West Africans than in Europeans. Our findings could account entirely for the higher rate of prostate cancer in African Americans than in European Americans. We could conclude this because African Americans who happen to have entirely European ancestry in this small section of their genomes had about the same risk for prostate cancer as random European Americans. In 2008, I gave a talk about my work on prostate cancer to a conference on health disparities across ethnic groups in the United States. In my talk, I tried to communicate my excitement about the scientific approach and my conviction that it could help define genetic risk factors for other diseases. Afterward, though, I was angrily questioned by an anthropologist in the audience, who believed that by studying West African or European segments of DNA to understand biological differences between groups, I was flirting with racism. Her questions were seconded by several others, and I encountered similar responses at other meetings. A legal ethicist who heard me talk on a similar theme suggested that I might want to refer to the populations from which African Americans descend as Cluster A and Cluster B. But I replied that it would be dishonest to disguise the model of history that was driving this work. Every feature of the data I looked at suggested that this model was a scientifically meaningful one, providing accurate estimates of where in the genome people harbor segments of DNA from ancestors who lived in West Africa or in Europe in the last 20 generations, prior to the mixture caused by colonialism and the slave trade. It was also clear that the approach was identifying real risk factors for disease that differ in frequency across populations, leading to discoveries with the potential to improve health. Far from being extremists, my questioners were articulating a mainstream view about the danger of work exploring biological differences among human populations. In 1942, the anthropologist Ashley Montague wrote Man's Most Dangerous Myth, The Fallacy of Race, arguing that race is a social concept and has no biological reality, and setting the tone for how anthropologists and many biologists have discussed this issue ever since. A classic example often cited is the inconsistent definition of black. In the United States, people tend to be called black if they have sub-Saharan African ancestry, even if it is a small fraction and even if their skin color is very light. In Great Britain, black tends to mean anyone with sub-Saharan African ancestry who also has dark skin. In Brazil, the definition is different yet again. A person is only black if he or she is entirely African in ancestry. If black has so many inconsistent definitions, how can there be any biological meaning to race? Beginning in 1972, genetic arguments began to be incorporated into the assertions that anthropologists were making about the lack of substantial biological differences among human populations. In that year, Richard Lewontin published a study of variation in protein types in blood. He grouped the populations he analyzed into seven races: West Eurasians, Africans, East Asians, South Asians, Native Americans, Oceanians, and Indigenous Australians, and found that around 85% of variation in the protein types could be accounted for by variation within populations and races, and only 15% by variation across them. He concluded, races and populations are remarkably similar to each other, with the largest part by far of human variation being accounted for by the differences between individuals. Human racial classification is of no social value and is positively destructive of social and human relations. Since such racial classification is now seen to be of virtually no genetic or taxonomic significance either, no justification can be offered for its continuance. In this way, through the collaboration of anthropologists and geneticists, a consensus was established that there are no differences among human populations that are large enough to support the concept of biological race. Lewontin's results made it clear that for the great majority of traits, human populations overlap to such a degree that it is impossible to identify a single biological trait that distinguishes people in any two groups, which is intuitively what some people think of when they conceive of biological race. But this consensus view of many anthropologists and geneticists has morphed, seemingly without questioning, into an orthodoxy that the biological differences among human populations are so modest that they should in practice be ignored. And moreover, because the issues are so fraught, that study of biological differences among populations should be avoided, if at all possible. It should come as no surprise, then, that some anthropologists and sociologists see genetic research into differences across populations, even if done in a well-intentioned way, as problematic. They are concerned that work on such differences will be used to validate concepts of race that should be considered discredited. They see this work as located on a slippery slope to the kinds of pseudo-scientific arguments about biological difference that were used in the past to try to justify the slave trade, the eugenics movement to sterilize the disabled as biologically defective, and the Nazis' murder of 6 million Jews. The concern is so acute that the political scientist Jacqueline Stevens has even suggested that research and even emails discussing biological differences across populations should be banned, and that the United States should issue a regulation prohibiting its staff or grantees from publishing in any form, including internal documents and citations to other studies, claims about genetics associated with variables of race, ethnicity, nationality, or any other category of population that is observed or imagined as heritable, unless statistically significant disparities between groups exist, and description of these will yield clear benefits for public health, as deemed by a standing committee to which these claims must be submitted and authorized. The language of ancestry. But whether we like it or not, there is no stopping the genome revolution. The results that it is producing are making it impossible to maintain the orthodoxy established over the last half century, as they are revealing hard evidence of substantial differences across populations. The first major engagement between the genome revolution and anthropological orthodoxy came in 2002, when Mark Feldman and his colleagues showed that by studying enough places in the genome, they analyzed 377 variable positions, it is possible to group most people in a worldwide population sample into clusters that correlate strongly to popular categories of race in the United States: African, European, East Asian, Oceanian, or Native American. While Feldman's conclusions were broadly consistent with Lewontin's, in that his data also showed more variation within groups than among them, his study defined clusters in terms of combinations of mutations, instead of looking at mutations individually, as Lewontin had done. Scientists were quick to respond. One was Svante Paabo, who 8 years later would go on to lead the work to sequence whole genomes of archaic Neanderthals and Denisovans. Paabo came to the debate about the nature of human population structure as a founding director of the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, which was set up in 1997 in an effort to return Germany to a field in which it had played a leading role before the Second World War, but that it had largely abandoned due to anthropologists' central contribution to developing Nazi race theory. Paabo took seriously his moral responsibility as a head of an ambitious German Institute of Anthropology, and wondered whether the truth about human population structure could be more like the anthropologist Frank Livingston's suggestion that there are no races, there are only clines, a view in which human genetic variation is characterized by gradual geographic gradients that reflect interbreeding among neighbors. To explore this possibility, Paabo investigated whether the clusters the Feldman study found appeared sharply defined, because the analyzed populations have been sampled in a non-random fashion across the world. To understand how non-random sampling could contribute to this result, consider the United States, which harbors extraordinary diversity, but where genetic discontinuities among groups such as African Americans, European Americans, and East Asians are sharper than in the places from which immigrant populations came, because the United States has drawn its immigrants from a subset of world locations. For example, in the United States, most of the African ancestry is from a handful of groups in West Africa. Most of the European ancestry is from Northwest Europe, and most of the Asian ancestry is from Northeast Asia. Paabo showed that such non-random sampling could account for some of the effects Feldman and colleagues observed. However, later work proved that non-random sampling could not account for most of the structure, as substantial clustering of human populations is observed even when repeating analyses on geographically more evenly distributed sets of samples. Another flurry of discussion followed a 2003 paper led by Neil Risch, who argued that racial grouping is useful in medical research, not just to adjust for socioeconomic and cultural differences, but also because it correlates with genetic differences that are important to know about when diagnosing and treating disease. Risch was convinced by examples like sickle cell disease, which occurs far more often in African Americans than in other populations in the United States. He argued that it was appropriate for doctors to be more likely to think of sickle cell disease if the patient is African American. In 2005, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration lent support to this way of thinking when it approved Bidil, a combination of two medications approved to treat heart failure in African Americans, because data suggested it was more effective in African Americans than in European Americans. But on the other side of the argument, David Goldstein suggested that U.S. racial categories are so weakly predictive of most biological outcomes that they do not have long-term value. He and his colleague showed that the frequencies of genetic variants that determine dangerous reactions to drugs are poorly predicted by U.S. census categories. He acknowledged that the reliance on racial and ethnic categories is useful, given our poor present knowledge, but predicted that the future will involve testing individuals directly for what mutations they have, and doing away altogether with racial classification as a basis for making individualized decisions about care. Against this backdrop of controversy emerged work like mine, focusing on methods to determine population origin, not just of our ancestors, but also of individual segments of our genomes. The anthropologist Duanna Fulmiley has written that the development of what she calls admixture technology and the language of ancestry that geneticists like me have adopted is a reversion to traditional ideas of biological race. She has pointed out that in the United States, the ancestry terms that we use map relatively closely to traditional racial categories. And her view is that the population genetics community has invented a set of euphemisms to discuss topics that had become taboo. The belief that we have embraced euphemisms is also shared by some on the other side of the political spectrum. At a 2010 meeting I attended at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, the journalist Nicholas Wade described his resentment of the population genetics community's ancestry terminology, asserting that race is a perfectly good English word. But ancestry is not a euphemism, nor is it synonymous with race. Instead, the term is born of an urgent need to come up with a precise language to discuss genetic differences among people, at a time when scientific developments have finally provided the tools to detect them. It is now undeniable that there are non-trivial average genetic differences across populations in multiple traits, and the race vocabulary is too ill-defined and too loaded with historical baggage to be helpful. If we continue to use it, we will not be able to escape the current debate, which is mired in an argument between two indefensible positions. On the one side, there are beliefs about the nature of the differences that are grounded in bigotry and have little basis in reality. On the other side, there is the idea that any biological differences among populations are so modest that, as a matter of social policy, they can be ignored and papered over. It is time to move on from this paralyzing false dichotomy and to figure out what the genome is actually telling us. Real biological difference. I have deep sympathy for the concern that genetic discoveries about differences among populations may be misused to justify racism. But it is precisely because of this sympathy that I'm worried that people who deny the possibility of substantial biological differences among populations across a range of traits are digging themselves into an indefensible position, one that will not survive the onslaught of science. In the last couple of decades, most population geneticists have sought to avoid contradicting the orthodoxy. When asked about the possibility of biological differences among human populations, we have tended to obfuscate, making mathematical statements in the spirit of Richard Lewontin about the average difference between individuals from within any one population being around 6 times greater than the average difference between populations. We point out that the mutations that underlie some traits that differ dramatically across populations, the classic example is skin color, are unusual, and that when we look across the genome, it is clear that the typical differences in frequencies of mutations across populations are far less. But this carefully worded formulation is deliberately masking the possibility of substantial average differences in biological traits across populations. To understand why it is no longer an option for geneticists to lock arms with anthropologists and imply that any differences among human populations are so modest that they can be ignored, go no further than the genome bloggers. Since the genome revolution began, the internet has been alive with discussion of the papers written about human variation, and some genome bloggers have even become skilled analysts of publicly available data. Compared to most academics, the politics of genome bloggers tend to the right. Razib Khan and Dianakis Pontikos post on findings of average differences across populations in traits including physical appearance and athletic ability. The Eurogenes blog spills over with sometimes as many as 1,000 comments in response to postings on the charge topic of which ancient peoples spread Indo-European languages, a highly sensitive issue since, as discussed in Part 2, narratives about the expansion of Indo-European speakers have been used as a basis for building national myths and sometimes have been abused, as happened in Nazi Germany. The genome bloggers' political beliefs are fueled partly by the view that when it comes to discussion about biological differences across populations, the academics are not honoring the spirit of scientific truth-seeking. The genome bloggers take pleasure in pointing out contradictions between the politically correct messages academics often give about the indistinguishability of traits across populations, and their papers showing that this is not the way the science is heading. What real differences do we know about? We cannot deny the existence of substantial average genetic differences across populations, not just in traits such as skin color, but also in bodily dimensions, the ability to efficiently digest starch or milk sugar, the ability to breathe easily at high altitudes, and susceptibility to particular diseases. These differences are just the beginning. I expect that the reason we don't know about a much larger number of differences among human populations is that studies with adequate statistical power to detect them have not yet been carried out. For the great majority of traits, there is, as Lewontin said, much more variation within populations than across populations. This means that individuals with extreme high or low values of the great majority of traits can occur in any population, but it does not preclude the existence of subtler, average differences in traits across populations. The indefensibility of the orthodoxy is obvious at almost every turn. In 2016, I attended a lecture on race and genetics by the biologist Joseph L. Graves, Jr. at the Peabody Museum of Archaeology and Ethnography at Harvard. At one point, Graves compared the approximately 5 mutations known to have large effects on skin pigmentation and that are obviously different in frequency across populations to the more than 10,000 genes known to be active in human brains. He argued that in contrast to pigmentation genes, the patterns at genes particularly active in the brain would surely average out over so many locations, with some mutations nudging cognitive and behavioral traits in one direction and some pushing in the other direction. But this argument doesn't work, because, in fact, if natural selection has exerted different pressures on two populations since they separated, traits influenced by many mutations are just as capable of achieving large average differences across populations as traits influenced by few mutations. And indeed, it is already known that traits shaped by many mutations, as is probably the case for behavior and cognition, are at least as important targets of natural selection as traits like skin color that are driven by a small number of mutations. The best example we currently have of a trait governed by many mutations is height. Studies in hundreds of thousands of people have shown that height is determined by thousands of variable positions across the genome. A 2012 analysis led by Joel Hirshhorn showed that natural selection on these is responsible for the shorter average height in southern Europeans compared to northern Europeans. Height isn't the only example. Jonathan Pritchard led a study showing that in the last approximately 2,000 years, there has been selection for genetic variations that affect many other traits in Britain, including an increase in average infant head size and an increase in average female hip size, possibly to accommodate the increased higher average infant head size during childbirth. It is tempting to argue that genetic influence on bodily dimensions is one thing, but that cognitive and behavioral traits are another. But this line has already been crossed. Often, when a person participates in a genetic study of a disease, he or she fills out a form providing information on height, weight, and number of years of education. By compiling the information on the number of years of education for over 400,000 people of European ancestry, whose genomes have been surveyed in the course of various disease studies, Daniel Benjamin and colleagues identified 74 genetic variations, each of which has overwhelming evidence of being more common in people with more years of education than in people with fewer years, even after controlling for such possibly confounding factors as heterogeneity in the study population. Benjamin and colleagues also showed that the power of genetics to predict number of years of education is far from trivial, even though social influences surely have a greater average influence on this behavior than genetics. They showed that in the European ancestry population, in which they carried out their study, it should be possible to build a genetic predictor in which the probability of completing 12 years of education is 96% for the 20th of people, with the highest prediction compared to 37% for the lowest. How do these genetic variations influence educational attainment? The obvious guess is that they have a direct effect on academic abilities, but that is probably wrong. A study of more than 100,000 Icelanders showed that the variations also increase the age at which a woman has her first child, and that this is a more powerful effect than the one on the number of years of education. It is possible that these variations exert their effect indirectly by nudging people to defer having children, which makes it easier for them to complete their education. This shows that when we discover biological differences governing behavior, they may not be working in the way we naively assume. Average differences across populations in the frequencies of the mutations that affect educational attainment have not yet been identified. But a sobering finding is that older people in Iceland are systematically different from younger people in having a higher genetically predicted number of years of education. Augustin Kong, the lead author of the Icelandic study, showed that this reflects natural selection over the last century against people with more predicted education, likely because of selection for people who began having children at a younger age. Given that the genetic underpinnings of the number of years of education a person achieves have measurably changed within a century in a single population under the pressure of natural selection, it seems highly likely that the trait differs across populations too. No one knows how the genetic variations that influence educational attainment in people of European ancestry affect behavior in people of non-European ancestries, or in differently structured social systems. That said, it seems likely that if these mutations have an effect on behavior in one population, they will do so in others too, even if the effects differ by social context. And educational attainment as a trait is likely to be only the tip of an iceberg of behavioral traits affected by genetics. The Benjamin study has already been joined by others finding genetic predictors of behavioral traits, including one of more than 70,000 people that found mutations in more than 20 genes that were significantly predictive of performance on intelligence tests. For those who wish to argue against the possibility of biological differences across populations that are substantial enough to make a difference in people's abilities or propensities, the most natural refuge might be to make the case that even if such differences exist, they will be small. The argument would be that even if there are average differences across human populations in genetically determined traits affecting cognition or behavior, so little time has passed since the separation of populations that the quantitative differences across populations are likely to be trivially small, hearkening back to Lewontin's argument that the average genetic difference between populations is much less than the average difference between individuals. But this argument doesn't hold up either. The average time separation between pairs of human populations, since they diverged from common ancestral populations, which is up to around 50,000 years for some pairs of non-African populations, and up to 200,000 years or more for some pairs of sub-Saharan African populations, is far from negligible on the timescale of human evolution. if selection on height and infant head circumference can occur within a couple of thousand years. It seems a bad bet to argue that there cannot be similar average differences in cognitive or behavioral traits. Even if we do not yet know what the differences are, we should prepare our science and our society to be able to deal with the reality of differences, instead of sticking our heads in the sand and pretending that differences cannot be discovered. The approach of staying mum, of implying to the public and to colleagues that substantial differences in traits across populations are unlikely to exist, is a strategy that we scientists can no longer afford, and that, in fact, is positively harmful. If, as scientists, we fully abstain from laying out a rational framework for discussing human differences, we will leave a vacuum that will be filled by pseudoscience, an outcome that is far worse than anything we could achieve by talking openly. The Genome Revolution's Insight. On the question of whether traditional social categories of race correspond to meaningful biological categories, the genome revolution has already provided us with new insights that go far beyond the information that was available to the first population geneticists and anthropologists who grappled with the issue. In this way, the data provided by the genome revolution are potentially liberating, providing an opportunity for intellectual progress beyond the current stale framing of the debate. As recently as 2012, it still seemed reasonable to interpret human genetic data as pointing to immutable categories such as East Asians, Caucasians, West Africans, Native Americans, and Australasians, with each group having been separated and unmixed for tens of thousands of years. The 2002 study led by Mark Feldman produced clusters that corresponded relatively well to these categories, and the model seemed to be doing a good job of describing variation in many parts of the world, with some exceptions. In other papers, Feldman and his colleagues proposed a model for how this kind of structure could arise among human populations. Their proposal was that modern humans expanding out of Africa and the Near East, after around 50,000 years ago, left descendant populations along the way, which in turn budded off their own descendant populations, with the present-day inhabitants of each region being descended directly from the modern humans who first arrived. Their serial founder model was more sophisticated than that imagined by biological race theorists in the 17th to 20th centuries, but shared with it the prediction that after being established, human populations hardly mixed with each other. But ancient DNA discoveries have rendered the serial founder model untenable. We now know that the present-day structure of populations does not reflect the one that existed many thousands of years ago. Instead, the current populations of the world are mixtures of highly divergent populations that no longer exist in unmixed form. For example, the ancient North Eurasians, who contributed a large amount of the ancestry of present-day Europeans, as well as of Native Americans, and multiple ancient populations of the Near East, each as differentiated from the other as Europeans and East Asians are differentiated from each other today. Most of today's populations are not exclusive descendants of the populations that lived in the same locations 10,000 years ago. The findings that the nature of human population structure is not what we assumed should serve as a warning to those who think they know that the true nature of human population differences will correspond to racial stereotypes. Just as we had an inaccurate picture of early human origins before the ancient DNA revolution unleashed an avalanche of surprises, so we should distrust the instincts that we have about biological differences. We do not yet have sufficient sample sizes to carry out compelling studies of most cognitive and behavioral traits, but the technology is now available. And once high-quality studies are performed, which they will be somewhere in the world whether we like it or not, any genetic associations they find will be undeniable. We will need to deal with these studies and react responsibly to them when they are published. But we can already be sure that we will be surprised by some of the outcomes. Unfortunately, today there is a new breed of writers and scholars who argue not only that there are average genetic differences, but that they can guess what they are based on traditional racial stereotypes. The person who has most recently made a prominent argument that there is a genetic basis to stereotypes about differences across human populations is the New York Times journalist Nicholas Wade, who in 2014 published A Troublesome Inheritance, Genes, Race, and Human History. The abiding theme of Wade's reporting is the propensity of academics to band together to enforce orthodoxies and to be shown up by a band of rebels speaking the truth. He has written on scientific fraud, described the Human Genome Project as a monolith, wastefully spending the public's money, and attacked the value of genome-wide association studies for finding common genetic variations contributing to risk for diseases. Wade's Troublesome Inheritance ran with the theme again, suggesting that a politically correct alliance of anthropologists and geneticists has banded together to suppress the truth that there are significant differences among human populations, and that those differences correspond to classic stereotypes. One part of the argument has something to it. Wade correctly highlights the problem of an academic community trying to enforce an implausible orthodoxy. Yet the truth that he puts forward in opposition, the idea that not only are there substantial differences, but that they likely correspond to traditional racial stereotypes, has no merit. Wade's book combines compelling content with parts that are entirely speculative, presenting everything with the same authority and in the same voice, so that naive readers who accept the parts of it that are well argued are tempted to accept the rest. Worse, when compared to Wade's previous writing, in which the rebels speaking the truth were scholars of creativity and accomplishment, he does not identify any serious scholarship in genetics supporting his speculations. And yet, by celebrating those who have opposed the flawed orthodoxy, he implies wrongly that their alternative theories must be right. As an example of the speculations to which Wade gives pride of place, one of his chapters focuses on a 2006 essay by Gregory Cochran, Jason Hardy, and Henry Harpending, suggesting that the high average intelligence quotient, IQ, of Ashkenazi Jews, more than one standard deviation above the world average, and their disproportionate share of Nobel Prizes, about 100 times the world average, might reflect natural selection due to a millennium-long history in which Jewish populations practiced moneylending, a profession that required writing and calculation. They also pointed to the high rate in Ashkenazi Jews of Tay-Sachs disease and Gaucher disease, which are due to mutations that affect storage of fat in brain cells, and which they hypothesized rose in frequency under the pressure of selection for genetic variations, contributing to intelligence. They argued that these mutations might be beneficial when they occur in one copy, rather than the two needed to cause disease. This argument is contradicted by the evidence that these diseases almost certainly owe their origin to random bad luck. The fact that during the medieval population bottleneck that affected Ashkenazi Jews, the small number of individuals who had many descendants happened to carry these mutations. Yet Wade highlights the work on the basis that it might be right. Harpending has a track record of speculating without evidence on the causes of behavioral differences among populations. In a talk he gave at a 2009 conference on Preserving Western Civilization, he asserted that people of sub-Saharan African ancestry have no propensity to work when they don't have to. "I've never seen anyone with a hobby in Africa," he said, because, he thought, sub-Saharan Africans have not gone through the type of natural selection for hard work in the last thousands of years that some Eurasians had. Wade also highlighted A Farewell to Alms, a book by the economist Gregory Clark, suggesting that the reason the Industrial Revolution took off in Britain before it did elsewhere was the relatively high birth rate among wealthy people in Britain for the preceding five centuries, compared to less wealthy people. Clark argued that this higher birth rate spread through the population the traits needed for a capitalist surge, including individualism, patience, and willingness to work long hours. Clark admits that he cannot distinguish between the transmission of genes and the transmission of culture across the generations. But Wade nevertheless takes his argument as evidence that genetics might have played a role. I have spent some space discussing errors in Wade's book, because I feel it is important to explain that just because many academics have been engaged in trying to maintain an implausible orthodoxy, it does not mean that every unorthodox heretic is right. And yet, Wade suggests precisely this. He writes, "Each of the major civilizations has developed the institutions appropriate for its circumstances and survival. But these institutions, though heavily imbued with cultural traditions, rest on a bedrock of genetically shaped human behavior. And when a civilization produces a distinctive set of institutions that endures for many generations, that is the sign of a supporting suite of variations in the genes that influence human social behavior." In a written version of a nod and a wink, Wade is suggesting that popular racist ideas about the differences that exist among populations have something to them. Wade is far from the only person who is convinced he knows the truth about the differences among populations. At the same 2010 meeting on DNA, Genetics, and the History of Mankind, at which I first met Wade, I heard a rustling behind my shoulder and turned with a shock to see James Watson, who in 1953 co-discovered the structure of DNA. Watson had, until a few years earlier, been the director of the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, at which the meeting was held. A century ago, the laboratory was the epicenter of the eugenics movement in the United States, keeping records on traits in many people to help guide selective breeding, and lobbying for legislation that was passed in many states to sterilize people considered to be defective and to combat a perceived degradation of the gene pool. It was ironic, then, that Watson was forced to retire as head of Cold Spring Harbor after being quoted in an interview with the British Sunday Times newspaper as having said that he was inherently gloomy about the prospect of Africa, adding that all our social policies are based on the fact that their intelligence is the same as ours, whereas all the testing says not really. No genetic evidence for this claim exists. When I saw Watson at Cold Spring Harbor, he leaned over and whispered to me, and to the geneticist Beth Shapiro, who was sitting next to me, something to the effect of, "When are you guys going to figure out why it is that you Jews are so much smarter than everyone else?" He then said that Jews and Indian Brahmins were both high achievers because of genetic advantages conferred by thousands of years of natural selection to be scholars. He went on to whisper that Indians, in his experience, were also servile, much like he thought they had been under British colonialism, and he speculated that this trait had come about because of selection under the caste system. He also talked about how East Asian students tended to be conformist because of selection for conformity in ancient Chinese society. The pleasure Watson takes in challenging establishment views is legendary. His obstreperousness may have been important to his success as a scientist, but now, as an 82-year-old man, his intellectual rigor was gone, and what remained was a willingness to vent his gut impressions without subjecting them to any of the testing that characterized his scientific work on DNA. Writing now, I shudder to think of Watson, or of Wade, or their forebears, behind my shoulder. The history of science has revealed, again and again, the danger of trusting one's instincts, or of being led astray by one's biases, of being too convinced that one knows the truth. From the errors of thinking that the sun revolves around the earth, that the human lineage separated from the great ape lineage tens of millions of years ago, and that the present-day human population structure is 50,000 years old, whereas, in fact, we know that it was forged through population mixtures largely over the last 5,000 years. From all of these errors and more, we should take the cautionary lesson not to trust our gut instincts or the stereotyped expectations we find around us. If we can be confident of anything, it is that whatever differences we think we perceive, our expectations are most likely wrong. What makes Watson's and Wade's and Harpending's statements racist is the way they jump from the observation that the academic community is denying the possibility of differences that are plausible to a claim with no scientific evidence that they know what those differences are, and also that the differences correspond to long-standing popular stereotypes, a conviction that is essentially guaranteed to be wrong. We truly have no idea right now what the nature or direction of genetically encoded differences among populations will be. An example is the extreme overrepresentation of people of West African ancestry among elite sprinters. All the male finalists in the Olympic 100-meter race since 1980, even those from Europe and the Americas, had recent West African ancestry. The genetic hypothesis most often invoked to explain this is that there has been an upward shift in the average sprinting ability of people of West African ancestry due to natural selection. A small increase in the average might not sound like much, but it can make a big difference at the extremes of high ability. For example, a 0.8 standard deviation increase in the average sprinting ability in West Africans would be expected to lead to a 100-fold enrichment in the proportion of people above the 99.9999999th percentile point in Europeans. But an alternative explanation that would predict the same magnitude of effect is that there's simply more variation in sprinting ability in people of West African ancestry, with more people of both very high and very low abilities. A wider spread of abilities around the same mean and a 100-fold enrichment in West Africans in the proportion of people above the 99.999999th percentile point seen in Europeans is in fact exactly what is expected given the approximately 33% higher genetic diversity in West Africans than in Europeans. Whether or not this explains the dominance of West Africans in sprinting for many biological traits, including cognitive ones, there is expected to be a higher proportion of sub-Saharan Africans with extreme genetically predicted abilities. So how should we prepare for the likelihood that in the coming years, genetic studies will show that behavioral or cognitive traits are influenced by genetic variation, and that these traits will differ on average across human populations, both with regard to their average and their variation within populations? Even if we do not yet know what those differences will be, we need to come up with a new way of thinking that can accommodate such differences, rather than deny categorically that differences can exist, and so find ourselves caught without a strategy once they are found. It would be tempting, in the wake of the genome revolution, to settle on a new, comforting platitude, invoking the history of repeated admixture in the human past as an argument for population differences being meaningless. But such a statement is wrong-headed. As if we were to randomly pick two people living in the world today, we would find that many of the population lineages contributing to them have been isolated from each other for long enough that there has been ample opportunity for substantial, average, biological differences to arise between them. The right way to deal with the inevitable discovery of substantial differences across populations is to realize that their existence should not affect the way we conduct ourselves. As a society, we should commit to according everyone equal rights, despite the differences that exist among individuals. If we aspire to treat all individuals with respect, regardless of the extraordinary differences that exist among individuals within a population, it should not be so much more of an effort to accommodate the smaller, but still significant average differences across populations. Beyond the imperative to give everyone equal respect, it is also important to keep in mind that there is a great diversity of human traits, including not just cognitive and behavioral traits, but also areas of athletic ability, skill with one's hands, and capacity for social interaction and empathy. For most traits, the degree of variation among individuals is so large that any one person in any population can excel at any trait regardless of his or her population origin, even if particular populations have different average values due to a mixture of genetic and cultural influences. For most traits, hard work and the right environment are sufficient to allow someone with a lower genetically predicted performance at some task to excel compared to people with a higher genetically predicted performance. Because of the multidimensionality of human traits, the great variation that exists among individuals, and the extent to which hard work and upbringing can compensate for genetic endowment, the only sensible approach is to celebrate every person and every population as an extraordinary realization of our human genius, and to give each person every chance to succeed, regardless of the particular average combination of genetic propensities he or she happens to display. For me, the natural response to the challenge is to learn from the